Machines That Fail Us, a podcast by the Media and Culture Research Group at the University of St. Gallen about the human rights implications of AI errors and failures and our future with artificial intelligence. You're listening to the third episode of Season 2 of Machines That Fail Us. I'm Philippe Di Salvo, researcher and lecturer at the University of St. Gallen, where I'm part of the Media and Culture Research Group within the Institute for Media and Communications Management. I am also the host of this podcast, so thanks a lot for tuning in. This podcast delves into the societal consequences of failures in artificial intelligence and what these breakdowns can teach us about the broader implications of AI. We unpack these themes through conversations with global experts from fields like journalism, academia, activism, and the tech industry, each bringing different perspectives to the table. In the first two episodes of this season, we tackle topics like the role of AI in spreading mis and disinformation, as well as the often overlooked human labor behind the development of generative AI tools. Just a quick reminder before we start. You can find all episodes of Machines That Fail Us, including those of Season 1, on the websites of the University of St. Gallen and the Human Error Project, or on your own favorite podcast app. In this new episode, we turn our attention to the pressing need for regulation in the field of artificial intelligence, with a focus on how these technologies intersect with human rights, gender bias, deepfakes, and copyright, among other topics. As AI systems become more deeply embedded in our daily lives, critical questions also arise. How can we ensure that these tools uphold fundamental rights? What safeguards are in place or are still missing to prevent harm? And how do global power dynamics shape these regulatory conversations? This episode in particular also brings a much-needed perspective from Latin America, with particular attention to the Brazilian context. For this episode, I'm extremely happy to be joined by a colleague of my own university. Mariana Valente is an assistant professor for international economics law at the University of St. Gallen. She researches and teaches in the intersection between law, technology, and society, especially in regulating the digital economy and fundamental rights in the online environment. She has experience in equity policy, gender equality, access to knowledge, culture and education, intellectual property, and the impact of technologies on democracy and social mobilization. A Brazilian lawyer with a PhD from the University of São Paulo, she has also spent research and visit periods at UC Berkeley, LMU in Munich, and Yale Law School. She's also one of the directors of Internet Lab, a Brazilian think tank based in São Paulo, Brazil, working on internet policy, and she is a member of the Brazilian Senate Commission for Drafting an Artificial Intelligence Regulation. Mariana, it's great to have you on Machines That Fail Us, and thanks for joining the show.
Thank you, Philip. I'm happy to be here with you.
So my first question for you today is really connected with your work on the internet in Brazil. You are the founder and the associate director of Internet Law in Brazil, where you're also from. And I'm very interested in knowing how is the discourse around AI unfolding in Brazil and Latin America more in general? And do you see any difference compared to how the debate is going in Europe?
Yeah, sure. So yes, at Internet Lab, we have been working on this issue for a few years now already. And I was also one of the members of a legal experts commission that the Senate put together about 3 years ago to draft a first AI bill for Brazil. So I was very involved actually in the process that led to this bill that's being discussed right now. I'm also speaking from that perspective. Of course, it's not that I stand by completely by the bill, especially because now it's being negotiated and has changed a lot. But the general model is more or less what we discussed inside this commission. So I really had the chance to sit down and think about what does Brazil need in terms of an AI law or AI regulation, right? And of course, while we were discussing this, the AI Act was already under discussion in the EU. And I think it sort of set a standard for the world, especially in this model of dividing AI by risks, right?
Yeah.
AI that should be forbidden, AI that's high risk, AI that's low risk. And most of the legislations that are being proposed in Latin America, they follow that in a way or another. I think this was considered a very good model to separate those things, right? To create more obligations for AI that's considered more risky. But one thing that our bill in Brazil is doing, and that's very different from the EU AI Act, is that besides being risk-based, that is dividing obligations according to those risks, it's also rights-based.
Okay.
So it confers specific rights to citizens when they have contact, when they are meaningfully affected by these technologies. Most of these rights are rights that already exist in the law. Mm-hmm. They're specified for the context of AI, and that for further interpretation, both by companies and by courts, can be very important, right? So what does a right to be treated with dignity, let's say, mean in the context of AI? And that can mean very specific things. So for example, knowing that you're speaking to a chatbot and not to a person, or that you're in contact with something that's synthetic media, right? So there are different ways to approach this. In the case of the EU AI Act, what they're doing is specifying what the obligations of a provider or deployer are. And this is also present in the AI bill in Brazil that's under discussion. It's also the case in Chile. It's very similar to the general model that we're discussing in Brazil. But it's specified that citizens have these rights, meaning that they can also exercise these rights in the face of who is deploying these technologies, right? From the side of business, that has created some uproar because that might mean a lot of judicialization. Mm-hmm. It's not that this could not happen in other contexts, but since it's specified, it seems as if we're saying, well, citizens can go to courts. So one thing that we were also trying to create was this institutional system in which citizens don't have necessarily to go to court, but there's some administrative way of solving this.
Yeah.
The way it has moved forward in the negotiations is that some of these rights are conferred to citizens in every case. So for example, the right to information, mm-hmm, on the fact that you're in contact with AI, or if relevant decisions were made about you, right?
Yeah.
And some other rights, like the right to having a decision made about you reviewed by a human, for example, they only apply in the case of high-risk technology. So that's how these two things are combined. Mm-hmm. I would say that that's the most important difference. There are some small things as well, but that's the most important difference. And that has a lot to do with the tradition of law in Latin America.
Okay.
So there are many laws that have this model of being rights-based and enunciate principles, then rights, and then the specifics. But I think another thing that's important to say is that Latin America is also very diverse in terms of especially the relationship between civil society and the state. So in another research project, I'm looking at the differences between platform regulation in Mexico, Argentina, and Brazil, for example.
Yep.
And one of the things we've been realizing is that the civil society in Brazil, especially digital rights organizations like Internet Lab, is pushing a lot for state regulation of technologies. They really believe that the state has a role. Mm-hmm. And this is probably linked to this tradition in Brazil of civil society really participating in the state since the 80s, since Brazil was democratized after a dictatorship. Whereas if you speak to civil society organizations in Mexico, it's much more common that they will be much more suspicious of the state regulating these technologies and finding that we shouldn't trust this too much, that we shouldn't trust the state too much. So you can also see that difference between the states.
And in this rights-based approach that you just described, it resonates with me and with the podcast a lot because we are dealing with the errors of AI. So what can go wrong, for instance, when a machine is taking decisions about humans? So I'm also curious, you know, whether this issue of the errors of the potential, for instance, discrimination by AI systems, it's really there. It's the part of the debate, also beyond regulation, but also in culture or in politics or in the media.
In culture, for sure. Mm-hmm. would say that in the whole region, this is definitely something that has been part of the public debate for some years. People in general, not just experts, are concerned that AI discriminates. I wouldn't say people in general, not like everyone, but I think it is in the public debate.
Yeah.
If you ask around whether people would like to have machines making, let's say, court decisions about them, many people will have an opinion already on whether that's a good thing and how one could appeal, you know, if a decision is made by a machine. It's different also looking at the different countries. So Chile, for example, looks more at self-regulation, is a bit more suspicious of how to solve that. In the case of the debate in Brazil, you could see that in some different stances. So there's a lot of push from civil society to ban the use of facial recognition systems in public spaces.
Right.
Because of how real-time facial recognition makes mistakes, especially towards Black people.
Yeah.
And racism is such a present reality in Brazil, and it's particularly a present reality when you look at law enforcement. So there are different organizations in Brazil, and not just digital rights organizations, but Black movement organizations, for example, or public security organizations who are calling out for a ban on facial recognition technologies for those purposes.
Yeah.
There is a resistance from the Brazilian state to ban that, especially from the police forces. Actually, there are many technologies operating already right now doing that without a regulation. But yeah, that really, that idea that facial recognition systems, they make mistakes, I think it's also very, very established.
All right.
In Brazil. But then there are many people who would also think that it's better to have the technology doing mistakes than having nothing at all, especially in a place where there's so much violence. No, yeah, which is an idea that I don't agree with.
Okay. And we also seen AI systems or algorithmic systems do errors which are strongly like biased in terms of gender or like clearly misogynistic in the outcomes they provided. I know this is also one of the topics you do most of your research on. So what's your take on this? How is this kind of emerging in particular in the wake of the explosion of generative AI? How have you been kind of addressing this in your work as well?
So I think this has to be addressed, let's say, let's start from a more abstract level and go to the specifics. AI can be very sexist by providing outputs, let's say, that reinforce unequal gender norms. We see many examples of this. There's this very well-known case of Amazon recruiting tool that was basically just interviewing men, right? Because of how it was discriminating against the CVs of women. And then more recently, we've been speaking a lot about deepfakes.
Yeah.
So the databases that are used for training, they can express these norms because they can overly include women in some cases or exclude women in other cases, right? So for example, if you're talking about a database of a profession where women dominate, there can be many more women, and that tool can just learn that there are just women in that profession, for example.
Yeah.
There can be representation problems, like how women are represented in these databases. Then when the work of labeling this data is done, that can also follow these patterns, and that can be really done by humans, right?
Yes.
They're just expressing their bias when they're looking at the data. The coding also can express that. And I think it gets more complicated when we're talking about machines that learn from users, right? This feedback loop and fine-tuning. So let's say search mechanisms, for example, that are constantly being trained by us. Because when we look for something, they are learning from where we click at, and where we click at can really express our bias. So I think one thing that's important is that it's impossible to think of this problem just thinking of how a certain tool is designed from the beginning.
Right.
It really has to be an iterative process, right? In which bias is searched for in the different phases. I would say that it's not simple at all to face this. I think sometimes in the discourse, it really sounds like, well, you can just solve bias.
Yeah.
Is there even a possibility that there are AI tools that are free from bias, right? I don't believe in that.
Yeah.
That's never going to happen. But that also takes us to some questions about regulation, right? And some difficult questions that we were making, for example, ourselves on this commission. So when we're considering what developers and deployers, they have to do to avoid or eliminate gender bias, let's say, when they find gender bias, do they have to mitigate it or do they have to eliminate it? Is it reasonable to require that bias is eliminated? And probably this is going to appear in another phase of the process. And how do you create incentives for that to disappear? Or do you really want to punish any instance of bias that appears? That's really difficult. Those are difficult questions to make. But it's definitely very important that they're there, right? And that they're there in the different phases. I think in some ways, we can say that AI has made some of these problems worse, right? And one of those areas that I find really interesting is the area of personal assistants.
Yes.
Siri, for example, or Alexa. There's been a lot of discussion on why these personal assistants are female voices, for a start. Of course, over time, because of this criticism, these companies have also made other voices available.
Yeah.
In the beginning, most of them were just female voices. And this is something that I think if people don't stop to think about it, they don't really realize the impact that this has on gender norms in society, right? Just the fact that you're speaking to an assistant that's obeying you all the time, and that this assistant is thought of as someone who has a personality, because this is how this is designed, right? A character is thought of, someone who's helpful, someone who's going to be there for you, right? And support you. And this is a woman, right?
Of course.
And that's something that's harder to solve with legislation, I would say.
Yeah. And also this debate has been there now for years. Like, so, and this idea that these biases are more than a glitch, they are not like technical problems, but they represent broader societal issues, has been now being kind of discussed for, I don't know, 10 years. And have you seen like a learning curve and a kind of getting better process in this over these years, at least?
I have, indeed. I think just the fact that these things are being discussed, there are some reports out there. So, for example, UNESCO has a super interesting report on assistants, personal assistants. Many people doing research on that and gaining the media. I think definitely there will be less people nowadays saying, oh, yeah, it doesn't discriminate, than there would be 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, you still have to do a lot of work. Like, people will first have this idea that it's not AI that discriminates, it's humans, and that the AI is more neutral than humans, which is not a very good way to put it politically, technically, to just looking at how it all works, right? But I think these cases, people knowing that they're not getting a neutral response from AI, I think they're more known, and especially at policymaking, right? At the spaces where these things are discussed. That's on the one hand. On the other, I think we're really seeing this year that tech companies are really willing to give a step back on these discussions. And this creates a new, let's say, it's a new moment. I think on the one hand, we were moving toward understanding what's the best kind of regulation for this, considering all this complexity. And on the other hand, there was a lot of engagement with the company so that they would develop products that would take that into consideration, right? And I think there's much less faith on these companies taking those steps because they're actively either saying that they are not going to move forward. Actually, they're rolling back some of the policies, or they're doing that silently, which is also happening. We've had some news in the past weeks, which means that, so when companies decide they will do less, there's an empty space there if one wants to have those issues solved that could be filled with regulation, right?
Yes.
But in a context where these companies are also saying that they don't agree with those policies, those regulations are going to be developed in a space of more conflict. So I would say that right now, things are changing really fast and it's hard to say anything like how this is moving forward. But I would say that we're in a more difficult moment than we have been in the past years. I think we were moving forward. I think now we might be actually giving some steps back.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very complex problem if you look at the interconnections between politics and technology and the US in particular. And you mentioned deepfakes before, which are probably the worst manifestation of AI we have ever seen so far, at least. And I know you have been speaking about this recently also at RightsCon, which is one of the biggest conferences when it comes to like human rights connected to technology. And when we discuss deepfakes, usually we tend to hyper focus on kind of the misinformation, disinformation side of things in the context of the elections, whatsoever. But actually, the reality is that deepfake is a harassment. It's like assault on women particular. And there's already lots of evidence of that. Also, this is, of course, connected to regulation. That stuff shouldn't exist at all. But how do you see this in overall debate around AI? Is this getting enough attention?
Yeah, I think you put it very well. I think it gets a lot of attention when we're speaking about very famous people, especially in election contexts.
Yeah.
But there are many anonymous people, anonymous women and girls being harassed by this, right? So everywhere in the world, you see cases in schools, for example, where school boys or even school girls start doing fake videos of nudity or sexual activity of other girls.
It's literally being commodified, you know?
This is the kind of thing that doesn't get a lot of attention first, because it's very common that teenagers won't even tell adults of what's going on. And I think this TV show Adolescence that's been really trending is also very important to speak about that, about how certain things are happening just among young people and parents, teachers, just adults in general. They don't have a clue of what's going on. And in my research on online gender-based violence, I've seen that being the case with other technologies as well, right? Before deepfakes, that some videos of like supposed sexual behavior of girls were being assembled and shared in WhatsApp groups. And that would happen for years. And parents and teachers would only know that after a girl committed suicide in a school, you know, because of the kind of harassment that she was getting. And this is also happening everywhere and with anonymous girls. It could happen to boys as well. I think that has to be clear. But we're speaking of this entrenchment between technology and society.
Yeah.
Right. So the fact is that in most societies, I would say maybe in all societies, it's much more shameful, considered much more shameful for a woman to be caught in that situation, let's say, than for a man. That's going to be much more judged than for a boy, right? Because of the sexual expectations that there are relating to women and men in societies. And that's really like being used and happening. And then there's the question of what to do about it, right?
Yep.
In the case of deepfakes, what's interesting is that there are some apps out there that they sell themselves as being capable of doing that.
Mm-mm.
That's pretty clear that should be outlawed.
Yeah. I mean, there's no other way of using that if not for harassing people. So
exactly. And you can't have an app that has its main objective to do something that's illegal.
Yeah.
And I would say that even without specific deepfake laws, and there are many deepfake laws already around the world, even without specific, most jurisdictions already have something that forbids that, mm-hmm. right? Because of personality rights, because of different elements in the law. But then you have the more complex situation in which an image generator software or video generator software is not being sold for doing that. It's being sold for doing, like being offered for doing general image generation, but it still allows that, right? And we should really be speaking about creating functionalities that would forbid that. It is the case with many systems that if you try to create images of nudity of someone in specific, they already deny to do that, right? But of course, users are always trying to find a way around it. But this is definitely something that we should be discussing about, like the accountability and liability of providers, deployers who are allowing this to be made. I have the feeling that most of the discussion revolves around criminal liability of users who engage in that kind of behavior, which definitely is important. But I wonder if it's the best or most effective way to deal with this. you know, especially for speaking about teenagers. So yeah, of course, we are speaking of a cultural thing. What's really important there is that the underlying culture is this culture that makes nudity shameful, for example, for women, not for men, for girls and not for boys, right? But still, we're also speaking of technology, of a technology that wasn't there before and allows this to be done really easily and creating, let's say, unconsented images, of course.
Marianero, our time is unfortunately running out, but I would like to ask you at least one more question. And yeah. I know this would require at least an entire season of Machine Does Fail Us to be answered, but one of the open fields about issues on AI regulation today is copyright. Mm-hmm. And we have seen this exploding with generative AI and text-based creation lawsuits that are being kind of launched by publishers, newspapers, etc. And I would say copyright is so back in a sense in the conversation. And I do think copyright is really somehow what we need in order to rebalance the relationship
between
AI makers and artists, creators, researchers as us as well. So copyright is so back. That's the news, I would say.
That's such a great question. And it's such a huge discussion.
Yeah.
I find it quite mind-blowing because I think it involves different notions of fairness and copyright issues, but also issues of fairness broadly, right?
Yeah.
My first take is that this whole situation with generative AI is very unbalanced in that it disfavors artists, right? So imagine you're dealing with something that you feel might steal your job, your future earnings, and it uses your work to do so, right? What I'm trying to say with that is that although this is framed as a copyright question, I think it's much more than that. I've been seeing that the discussions around copyright and generative AI are revolving mostly around remuneration. And for most artists, when they get remunerated for the use of their work on generative AI, if we're not speaking of like a bestseller, let's say, for most artists, this means like cents or just a couple of Swiss francs a year, let's say. Which is why I'm saying that it's more than that. It's more than the feeling that my art must be remunerated because it's being used. It's this feeling of, wait, this is stealing my job and it's using my work. Like, how does that even come together, right? So the question that you make is really important. Is copyright the right instrument?
Yeah.
I would say that many people in my field who are also working with copyright, I've been working with copyright for over 10 years now, many people in my field, they don't believe so. They don't think that copyright is the best instrument because it's designed to really remunerate in these according to the use. And then we're speaking of a mass use, so that wouldn't work. That create a lot of hassle. My opinion might change over time. I'm also doing research about this, but I disagree. I think that copyright can be a very important instrument for that. I think that historically, copyright has been created, has developed to try to strike those balances between new technologies and the rights of those who do the creations, right? So this is not new.
Yeah.
When recorded music came out, there was this whole push towards creating new rights for the people who had their voices recorded, right? Which didn't have to exist before because people were basically performing live. And then suddenly they were saying, well, my voice is being recorded. I'm never going to perform live again, right? Because people are going to start listening to this.
Yeah.
Well, it's more or less like we're talking of the same movement. And I think that a solution has been found in copyright, more or less balanced, but a solution has been found over time. I feel that in this case, the change that we need might be of a different sort. It's not just about payments.
Yeah.
But copyright can be a tool, for example, for artists to opt out, right? Or like not agree with their work being used in AI training. Yep. That AI training needs to be done in databases that are specifically licensed for that. And I think that can have a role not just to the artists, but also in how databases that are going to be used are going to be more curated, let's say. And that this whole situation starts to be more negotiated and fairer, right? I think we have a very interesting example there when DeepSeek appears.
Yep.
And Sam Altman from OpenAI says that they're stealing. That they're stealing from OpenAI, right? Who didn't ask for authorization of anyone to train their own model. So there's still some very interesting questions there. I think, like, depending on how you frame this, the solution can be really, can have an adverse impact on other uses that are important that are free, right? Because not everything has to be protected. There needs a strike, a balance needs to be striked there. But I do think that copyright is this instrument that has over time given power to individuals, and that it can be framed in that. The problem is that usually when you create new rights, it's also intermediaries that amass most of those revenues and power and control. And then you have to really think of how to craft this so that this doesn't happen one more time.
Mariana, this was great, as everything else we discussed today. And it has been a great pleasure to have you on Machines That Fail Us. And thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Philip. Bye.
The Machines That Fail Us podcast is produced by the Media and Culture Research Group at the Institute of Media and Communications Management at the University of St. Gallen, together with the Communications Department of the University. The post-production is curated by Podcast Schmiede. The next episode of the podcast will be released next month. You can listen to all the episodes of Machines That Fail Us on the University of St. Gallen website, the Human Error Project website, and all major audio and podcasting platforms. This is Philip DiSalvo, and on behalf of the entire Media and Culture Research Group, thank you for listening.